The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Japan's economy gets a bad rap, and for most of the past 27 years, the so-called lost decades, that's largely been deserved. But don't let the past blind you to what's going on in Japan right now. It's still the world's third largest economy, and in case it escaped you, the stock market is a stone's throw from its highest level since the 90s. Japan's jobless rate is about half that of the United States, and corporate profits have never been better. And look at bank lending. It's growing the most since, again, the 1990s. Look, I know, we've had false dawns before. I even believed in one myself in 1999, during the 2 years I spent editing economics for Bloomberg in Tokyo. So if things are looking up, why isn't Japan getting credit? Why does everything always have to be about China? Welcome to Benchmark, a show about the global economy. I'm Daniel Moss, Executive Editor for Economics in New York. My guest co-host this week is Chris Anstey, a Managing Editor for Bloomberg in Tokyo and resident of that city for 7 years. Chris, it's great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Dan.
And your experience with Japan predates your move there 7 years ago.
Well, that's right. I was here as a teenager in the late 1980s. My dad was working here, and I went to an international school. I also came back after college and taught English for a year before I went back to the United States and spent the bulk of my year in the U.S. and U.K. And it's been fascinating to see Japan, the past 7 years compared with the 80s.
It does feel, though, doesn't it, like China just sucks all the oxygen out of the room when you have a conversation about Asian economics. And if Japan is discussed today, it's in the context of a long struggle with deflation and a shrinking population. And as we'll learn, that obscures what's been happening lately. But don't just take our word for it. Peter Tasker has been in and around Japan since the 1970s. He's a founding partner of Arcus Investments Limited, established in 1998. He also dabbles in Japanese detective fiction. Peter, great to have you.
Good to be here.
What's different this time? What is the popular narrative missing?
Most of the indicators that I look at are showing levels that we haven't seen since the mid-90s or even before. And if we look at, for example, the Japanese labor market, which you touched on, the job offer to applicants ratio has not been this high since the early 1970s. So even though the rate of growth, the natural rate of growth, has declined due to the population issue, we have a kind of high pressure economy developing here, and as a result, we're seeing a virtuous circle develop, in which you've got more consumption. And I think we will see more corporate investment and better improvement in the economy as a whole. Just the standard metrics that we look at are far better than anything we've seen. And this goes to, even some of the sort of social mood that we look at in, as you said, the two lost decades were a really dismal period for Japan. And one of the things, a very sad indicator of that, was the very large rise in the suicide rate, particularly after the first banking crisis in 1997. We saw a significant rise, almost 50%, in the suicide rate over the next 5 or 6 years. And it was concentrated on the sort of middle-aged male population, many of whom found themselves out of work or underemployed. Well, over the past 10 years, that has gone right back down again. There's been a huge decline in the suicide rate. It's gone right back down to where it was before that banking crisis. So there seems to be a sort of happier vibe socially, and that's no surprise when you see that there's a very high proportion of the population which is now employed. And I think that's an absolutely key metric, is that everybody who wants to work is working.
You know, Peter, like you, I really enjoy looking at the historical trend of indicators. And one great thing about the Bloomberg is you can track some of these way back to the 70s or 80s or in some cases even before. And what really kind of caught me on to something changing in Japan was when I looked at indicators like nominal GDP, which of course is unadjusted for price changes. That's the actual yen that's produced in the economy every year. Nominal GDP at a record again. You look at employment. You look at income across the economy, and it's pretty striking. The past few years, the trajectory has been much better than it was. You know, a phrase we like to use at Bloomberg is size and scope. The size and scope is the highest in decades. But why, Peter, do you think that, these headlines, you're obviously aware of this, some folks who follow Japan closely are aware of this, but the world seems to have largely forgotten about Japan. What do you think is the reason that people don't really recognize this story more widely?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is sort of long history of the relations and the image of Japan globally, going back to the war and then in the 1980s when it appeared that Japan was going to be an economic superpower of the 21st century. And many very, very smart people bought into that, and there was a huge flood of books about that, and Michael Crichton's film, what was it called again? Rising Sun.
Rising Sun.
Was marked the sort of peak of that. And then after the bubble burst, it turned out to be a bubble economy, and the foundations were built on sand. There was a sort of audible sigh of relief and a bit of schadenfreude, if you like, that Japan was actually doing pretty badly, and so the West could say, well, look at this. They're not doing it the way they should do, and they're doing it their own way, and it's all going wrong. See? I told you so.
I think you're just being diplomatic, Peter. Triumphalism is the term that comes to mind.
Triumphalism, yes, indeed. So what happened after that is that Japan has recovered, I believe, but it's recovered in a sort of stealth fashion. And it's now neither a challenger nor a disaster. It is what it is. Even so, I think that it's something that the rest of the world should pay a lot more attention to, because many of the issues they're dealing with, particularly the aging economy, the need to bring more people into the labor force, as we know, the labor participation rate in the U.S. is dismally low, whereas Japan has been very successful, not just in bringing the actual sort of technical working population, which is 15 to 65, but also bringing many seniors into the labor force as well. So we have over 20% of the over 65s in the labor force. So there are many things that Japan is doing which we could all learn from, and probably will need to go there before too long, because aging, though we present it as a some kind of disastrous demographic situation, is in reality a kind of triumph because it means that we've extended people's lifespans. And Japan has the second longest lifespan for males and females, or second or third. It's always been there or thereabouts. So what we need to do in most of the developed countries is to recognize that people live longer. They should be economically active longer, and they should work longer. And Japan is moved, I think, in quite a constructive way in this direction. Europe hasn't moved that way at all. I think America is sort of in the middle, but Japan is way ahead.
It's interesting that you mention Rising Sun. Both the book and the movie, they did seem to capture the zeitgeist of the moment, the sort of Japan as number one industrial complex. I wonder, though, you make me think, are we making the same mistake in the way the West views China now? That it's destined to be on top, it's destined to be the economic superpower of the 21st century, and some of the potential for problems, such as demographics, you know, they're just being swept under the carpet at the moment because it's the current mania.
Well, that's a good question, Dan. And obviously my experience in Japan is that never make predictions, especially about the future. And all those smart people who wrote that the 21st century was going to be Japanese supremacy again got egg on their face very, very quickly. So we should always challenge the assumptions, and we should always think of all the different scenarios that are out there and realize that our ability to be certain about them is very limited. And I think you're right that if you are sitting in Beijing, in Xi Jinping's seat, you would see a whole world of problems that you've got to face and not easy to deal with. Having said that, of course, China has made unbelievable progress in many areas, and particularly in moving up the value-added chain in technology. And so as a result of that, a country like Japan has moved out of many of the consumer brand icons that sell directly to the consumer that they were famous for in the 70s and 80s. Most of the Japanese high tech we see these days, apart from in autos, is in capital goods, which go into somebody else's branded products. So I think that's a change in the industrial structure, which also means that Japan's less visible as a sort of brand owner than it was going back 25, 30 years ago. But in fact, does it a huge amount of trade with China, and a lot of intermediary goods and capital goods and key components go into your iPhone or many of the other key products of today.
So, Peter, if I like your term that Japan is neither a challenger nor a disaster. So if that's the case, what sort of opportunities does this new kind of stealth dynamism in Japan create for investors and businesses outside Japan?
Yeah, well, talking about financial investment, one of the things that people find very hard to get their brains around is that a high-growth economy does not necessarily produce the best returns for investors. And there are a number of reasons for that, which I won't go into, but there's long studies, 100 years of stock market history, have shown that, if anything, the correlation is the other way around a bit. So we don't need Japan to grow rapidly in order to be an okay investment destination. What we do require is good values and good profitability from the companies, and I believe that we do have both those elements in place. Just to give you an example, the TOPIX index, which is sort of the major index of the stock market here, equivalent to the S&P, when it was peaking out right at the start of this century with the IT bubble, the EPS on topics was about 25 yen a share. Right now, it's 110 yen a share, and it's expected to rise to about 130 yen over the next couple of years. So in other words, there's been a huge improvement in profitability over that time. Now, the market itself is actually below where it was then, though the EPS on the market is 4 to 5 times higher. So obviously, that's a much better investment environment with in terms of valuations and company profits. I think you also need a more stable macroeconomic environment. To some extent, the policymakers have a role to play here. And being generally a more accommodative and easier in the macro policy settings have led to more confidence for companies. And actually, this sort of environment that we're seeing now, again, we're talking about small numbers here, but Japan has been growing well ahead of its natural rate of growth, which is simply productivity growth because the working population is not rising. Year after year, therefore, you are soaking up all the used capacity. And we're starting to see some wage rises, particularly in the part-timer space. They're not huge, but you're talking about 2.5%, 2.6% with a very lower inflation still. So a much better environment. And for investors, I think we've got a more stable macro environment and we've got better profitability and valuations than we've seen for, I would say, since the 60s.
You know, Peter, you mentioned the labor force and running out of spare capacity there. One thing that I've started to think about is, you know, if you look at the past couple of decades, there were periodic episodes of a very strong exchange rate in Japan, which really kind of shook out the exporters. It forced them to become more productive. It sent some of them out of business. It sent many of them pushing manufacturing and jobs overseas. And arguably, it left those that survived, the Toyotas and others, in stronger shape. And I'm wondering if the labor shortages and the emergence of labor cost pressures domestically will do the same thing for the domestic economy, that you will see a shakeout with some not able to survive the increasing costs and others left in stronger position with more productive workforces.
Yeah, I think you're right, because I think the, you know, this sort of tight labor market is driven by two things. One is sort of decent economic performance, but the other is the demographic limitations. So what I think we'll see over the medium term is this really forcing all kinds of shakeouts and consolidation of industries. So many industries in Japan have got a huge number of players in the industries, and you don't have that situation. Many mature economies, you would have the top 4 or 5 companies that have an overwhelming share of that market. That's not really the case in Japan. You often have hundreds and hundreds of companies. I think we're going to see over the next decades, in fact, a great deal of consolidation there and mergers and acquisitions as well. We also see a great deal of automation of activities that are done by people, and there's a tremendous room for that, particularly in the service sector. I would say particularly in things like the banking sector. If you go into a branch of a bank in Japan, you'll see that they're still got a large number of personnel in there, despite all the potential that we have these days for reducing that. So I think what we're going to see is bigger companies emerge in many of the service sectors, which so far have been very overpopulated company-wise, and we're going to see more innovation in terms of personnel reducing technology, sort of robotization, if you like. We've just looking at one company which has got a 70% share in small-scale sushi robots. I mean, this is perhaps one of the way things are going to go over many years to come.
What does a sushi robot do, Peter?
Well, it can't actually put the fish in, but it can make a nice sushi thing for you, and then you have to put the fish in yourself. You need a bit of human skill to do that. But yes, it rolls the sushi for you. But again, I would say that these are all phenomenon which, if you look at the sort of overall growth rate, it will be average. Nothing much will change, but the quality of it will be much improved.
Peter, before we close, let's talk a little bit about your other occupation, writing detective fiction. And I understand this is based around an anti-hero called Mori. How has he navigated Japan's economy in the past couple of decades? And what does he make of this optimism right now? Is he feeling it?
He's been at the raw end of deflation, actually. Like many people in service industries, he's found that the kind of fees that are available for him for the work he does have gone down and made it very difficult to cover his costs. So though he's not really an economic person, an economist, yes, he's suffered from the lost decades. And the other thing about Mori is, of course, that the way I constructed him, that he was basically a sort of 1960s guy or early 70s guy. So he's getting on a bit now. But, of course, in Japan, that is no barrier to being cool and doing your stuff. So people carry on doing all kinds of things, whether it's climbing Everest or whatever else it may be, well into their 70s and 80s. So I think that Mori can still keep going, he can challenge the stereotypes of the problem of demographics actually being instead an opportunity.
What's your favorite detective novel ever?
Favorite one ever? Well, of course, there are so many classics. Chandler is really wrote the book, but I'm very fond of Ed McBain, actually. His stuff is great.
Do you like Philip Kerr's character, Bernie Gunther?
Yes, I do. I do like that, yes, and the more modern stuff, yes, that's good.
Peter, it's been an absolute treat to have you here on the show, and we hope you'll come back again.
My pleasure entirely.
Well, Benchmark will be back next week, and until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, our Bloomberg app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, and Stitcher. While you're there, take a minute to rate and review the show so more listeners can find us. And let us know what you thought of the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Moss_Eco, and Chris, you are at?
AnstyAsia, A-N-S-T-E-Y, Asia.
Benchmark is produced by Sarah Patterson. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Alec McKate, a shameless cinephile. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.